Hello, welcome to episode 58 of the award-nominated Prestige Performance Podcast. Thanks a million to everyone who has voted for me, everyone who has got in touch. I really appreciate it. Delighted to be joined this evening by a man whose work I have been really interested in for some time now. My guest this evening is Dr. Martin Turner, a reader in psychology at Manchester Met University. Martin is a registered sport and exercise psychologist. As a practitioner, he has worked within a vast range of sports, both at team and individual levels. Currently, he is the lead psychologist for Scarlets Rugby and integrates a counselling framework called Rational Emotive Behaviour Therapy into his work to optimise both well-being and sporting performance. Martin, thanks so many for taking the time.
Hey, thanks for inviting me. Great to be with you.
Pleasure. Martin, I thought I'd start by reading a short extract out of your first book, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, of course.
So, an individual who asserts that their emotions and behaviors are a direct result of external events surrenders their agency in terms of influencing their own response. If someone takes the view that losing the match made them depressed, the only way to influence the depression is not to have lost the match in the first place. So, having said that, and given that people who are listening to that intro possibly are thinking, what the hell is rational emotive behavior therapy? What is rational emotive behavior therapy at its core?
Yeah, well, at its core, it's an approach to work, approach to working psychotherapeutically, or an approach to coaching, working as a sports psychologist, which essentially asserts that whilst events can trigger emotions, they don't do so alone. We contribute to that through the way that we think, the things we believe, our ideas and notions about the world, our beliefs. We contribute to those events and that transaction between the event and our emotional response. So we as human beings have a huge say in how we respond to our adversity, to stressors. And RBT helps people to figure out, well, if we have a say over those emotions, then what say do we want to have? How can we shape our emotions? What are the things that we might be able to think and believe that might help us to respond adaptively to life's challenges, of which there are many?
You touched on an interesting point there that I will come back to. But I suppose briefly, just to, as a segue into our conversation, could you tell my listeners a little bit about the origins of REBT?
Yeah, sure. So RBT emanates really in the 1950s formally through somebody called Albert Ellis. Albert Ellis, based in New York as a psychotherapist, trying to figure out how to help people. Ellis, you know, professed to having a gene for efficiency, somebody who was kind of motivated to help as many people as possible, was using a mode of therapy at that time, which was very long form, would take a long time for people to discover how they can kind of, you know, get out of their malaise. So starts to understand from the clients he's working with, as well as his reading of ancient philosophy, particularly Stoicism, starts to understand that often his patients, clients, are perpetuating their own issues through certain ways of thinking, certain ways of believing about themselves, the world, and other people. So he starts to formulate this cognitive-based therapy, which is all about helping people to understand and discover some of the faulty, problematic cognitions they might have, and then helping them to essentially weaken them and then strengthen cognitions, thoughts, ideas that will kind of help them in terms of, you know, attaining whatever life goals they had. So, you know, we get that coming out of the 50s, kind of mid to late 50s. Now, at the same time, we have Aaron Beck, who starts to work specifically, probably more scientifically than Ellis, on what would become cognitive therapy. Those two things, REBT and cognitive therapy, or CT, start to become like a really kind of huge weapon when it comes to psychotherapy and helping people. These new cognitively based psychotherapies start to really dominate. And then what we have today is this notion of CBT, which is a family of psychotherapies, of which RBT and cognitive therapy comfortably sit.
In terms of, I suppose, you refer to them as unhelpful thoughts or unhelpful styles of thinking. As a practitioner, I'm trying to, I suppose, tailor this podcast toward maybe trainee sports psychologists, or so I'm going to assume no prior knowledge for any of my listeners. Would it be fair to say that a key part of the therapeutic process, as you just mentioned, is helping the client develop the self-awareness regarding the unhelpful thinking styles that are perpetuating their issues?
Yeah, for sure. You're really, one of the things that RBT makes quite clear and how we work with people is one of the aims that we have is for ourselves to become redundant. The idea is that we help the individual through self-discovery, but also psychoeducation to understand, how do I access these beliefs? How do I start to discover some of the thoughts and beliefs that aren't helping me? And then what rules can I apply when I've kind of discovered those beliefs to help weaken them? And then what rules can I apply to then adopt, instantiate and strengthen beliefs that might help me? So this process, if you like, of working with somebody includes furnishing them with the tools to then help themselves going forward. Albert Ellis wrote many, many self-help books and really believed in individuals' agency to kind of help themselves, really, if they could learn these particular rules and ideas and principles.
I suppose in general, the idea of integrating counseling frameworks at all into sport or sports psychology, is it fair to say that's a relatively new concept?
I think we've made it explicit more recently. Attending things like the Division of Sport and Exercise Psychology conferences, which is a British Psychological Society conference, runs annually, used to run biannually. We start to see in kind of the 2010s to 13, 14s, we start to see mental health becoming a key theme within DSEP. When you go to conferences, you know, this theme starts to emerge. People starting to write more about this concept. And because mental health becomes something of interest to sport and exercise psychologists more so than it was in the past, I think that it grabs with it potential treatments for those mental health issues, and psychotherapies is obviously going to be relevant there. But I actually think the idea of psychological skills training that we would often use with athletes, Mark Anderson's canon of psychological skills, is ostensibly cognitive behavioral. It comes from that cognitive behavioral therapeutic tradition. We do have literature going back to, you know, 80s and 70s, which talk about this and bring with it psychotherapeutic ideas and counseling ideas. But I think that it's probably only more recently, in the past 10 years or so, that we've been really, really explicit about this stuff. So when I see literature concerning psychological skills training, I now understand that this is a cognitive behavioral approach to sports psychology. We've just lost that link a little bit, so it's not as explicit in literature. But now I think we're starting to restore that in a more meaningful way. So we actually start to piece things together, looking backwards, saying, okay, well, that's a psychological skills training intervention from the 90s. What are they doing? Oh, well, it's CBT-based techniques and strategies. So I think these days we're making it more explicit. I would say that sports psychology has always been steeped in counselling approaches and psychotherapeutic approaches. We're just becoming more aware of those links, you know?
Yeah. I think before we chat about the ABC model, but correct me if you want to, you're the expert, I might introduce the four irrational beliefs first and then go into maybe...
Yeah, please. Yeah, absolutely.
So the first irrational belief, if you wouldn't mind telling my listeners, demanding beliefs.
So demanding beliefs are where you transfer a preference into a demand. So you would say, I would like to succeed. I would like to be approved of. I would like to be treated fairly and with respect. But I don't. I wouldn't just like to be. I must be. I have to be treated in this way. And I absolutely should be treated in this way. So what you're doing is you're demanding something that you want. Now, the issue there is it's a non sequitur. Just because you want something, you might want it more than anything in the world, doesn't make it an obligation that it happens or you get what you want. The second problem is, as we know in performance, the outcomes are uncontrollable. When we look at the irrational beliefs, they're often about things that are not within our control. So you can want to be approved of. That's a natural thing for people to want to do. As we're a social species, it makes sense. But as soon as you demand it, then you are placing demands on things you can't control. I can't control what somebody thinks about me, whether they approve of me or whatever. Or I can't control how people treat me. I can have an influence on it, but I can't control it. So once I start demanding it, then I'm on a road to nowhere because I'm not going to get the things that I demand. That's not really how the world works. So that language of must and should and have to invokes pressure, but it also applies rigid rules to a world that is not rigid. It's in flux and it's flexible.
Two thoughts coming to mind, if I may. The first one, by using such extreme language, should, must, have to, for example, I have to score. You're kind of already setting yourself up for failure, aren't you? And then the problem is, if you don't score, you're probably going to feel pretty crap about yourself. So,
Well, yeah, it's two things there, isn't it? One of them is, how does it set me up to execute that skill, having a have to? From what we're showing in the research we're doing, it elevates anxiety, and we know that highly anxious people who apply irrational beliefs tend not to perform those skills well under pressure. So it actually might harm your ability to achieve what you're demanding. And then secondly, which is the second point you were kind of going on to before I interrupted, the consequences of me failing are now exacerbated, because if I don't do something that I must do, then I can convince myself that it's the end of the world and it's a catastrophe and all the rest of it. So you kind of have it, you know, pretty bad at both ends. Now, if you kind of fast forward to me repeating that habit of constantly demanding and constantly placing those demands on myself over a series of months and years and decades as I compete or partake in any sort of working type career, that's when we start to see, you know, more mental health type problems. It's less about skill execution and more about how able am I to look after myself. To what extent can somebody sustain a career where they're constantly placing demands on themselves? There's a question mark over that, you know. So there's an acute issue with irrational beliefs, but there's also a chronic issue as well.
Another point that occurred to me there, placing demanding beliefs, should statements, have to, is placing such beliefs onto other people. For example, Jimmy should treat me a certain way, or my coach should treat me a certain way. And then if your coach or Jimmy doesn't treat you the way that you think you should be treated, that also, I think, could maybe lead to low mood and the other negative kind of consequences you have touched on there.
Of course, yeah, because if you place demands, I mean, on things you can't control, which is pretty much always other people. As I said before, really, it's possible to influence people's actions. Of course it is. And you can request that people act in the way that you want to be treated, but you ultimately can't control it. And, you know, it comes back to the what you read from my first book earlier. If I'm somebody who allows myself to be triggered by people's behavior, and I also apply demands to that behavior, then I'm going to double down on my emotional suffering. Not only am I going to be emotionally reactive to the world around me in a way that is highly sensitive, and therefore I'm more likely to suffer, because guess what? People aren't going to treat you the way you want to be treated. They will treat you unfairly. You will fail. And then if I'm triggered by that stuff, then I'm going to suffer more. And then if I apply shoulds and musts to those behaviors that I want to see from people, then it's going to multiply my suffering, because it goes against a rule that I hold dear. I'm going to feel ever so more transgressed. If you do something I don't want you to do, it's going to be different to if you do something you should not do. It goes against my rule. Once I set those rigid rules in place, then I set myself up for more suffering.
The second irrational belief, awfulizing. Would you mind telling me a little bit more about that, please?
So awfulizing often gets confused with catastrophizing. Catastrophizing is where you kind of magnify the badness of an event, where you think it's worse than it actually is. Awfulizing is when you take it to the extreme, where a bad event might happen. Something that obviously you don't want to happen happens. It's adverse. And you evaluate that situation as the worst thing that could possibly happen. It's awful. It's terrible. It's the end of the world. It's the worst thing imaginable. So that's problematic in multiple ways, partly because you will face bad things. It's part of the human experience, is to face adversity. If you view adversity as something that is catastrophic, then okay, yes, that you want to magnify the effects of that bad event emotionally. If you evaluate it as awful, as terrible, the worst thing possible, then you can imagine that my reaction to that bad event is going to be even more extreme. So often when we have people with those kinds of beliefs, it's often associated with anxiety. If athletes are injured, it's associated with a greater perception of pain. We kind of try to help people to temper that awfulizing, to recognize that, well, it's bad. Of course it is. We can both agree that this event goes against one of your goals. But can we necessarily agree that it's the worst thing that's possible to happen? We probably can't agree on that, because we can probably both, practitioner and client, can probably both find things that would be objectively worse than what has happened to you. It's a particularly pernicious belief when it comes to anxiety, I would say.
You mentioned the idea of an injured athlete there. So I'll stick with the idea of an injured athlete. In the context of an injured athlete, can you explain the concept of the third irrational belief, low frustration tolerance, to me, please?
Yeah, sure. So if we have an injured athlete who believes that they cannot tolerate being injured, they can't stand it, it's unbearable, then again, we've got a distorted evaluation of the event that's happening. Low frustration tolerance or frustration intolerance is quite curious, because if somebody's sitting in front of you telling you they can't stand something, their mere continued existence is evidence that they can tolerate it, you know? Mm. And there's a subtlety around this. So yes, we can recognize that something's tough and difficult. It's always tolerable until you die, at which point you don't need to tolerate it anymore. So everything is tolerable, but you have a choice to make. Do I choose to tolerate this or not? There's a difference between can stand and will stand. So what you would do when you're working with somebody is to help them to understand that they can tolerate pretty much anything, but there are certain things they might choose not to tolerate. So we had an example earlier of, you know, a coach treating me badly. I can tolerate that poor treatment, but I might choose not to. It's up to me to then take some action if I feel strongly enough about it and I feel like it's the right thing to do. So it's important here that this idea that of tolerance isn't construed as a passive tolerance. You're not just going to walk all over me. You know, I can tolerate the way you're treating me, but I choose not to. I'm going to address it. So low frustration tolerance within the context of injury, you know, if somebody's intolerant of that injury, then it's likely to exacerbate their suffering again. You know, they're going to feel worse about that situation. They convince themselves that they can't tolerate it.
And the fourth one, depreciation. Do you want to tell my listeners what that is about, please?
This is the big one. I think in the research that myself and others have done, the data we have and my experience working in the applied world, this one is very final. And that's why I think it's so problematic. If I have failed, it means that I'm a complete failure. If I have, fallen short of my expectations, then it means I'm a complete idiot. I'm useless. I'm worthless. I have no value. If you treat me badly, you're a bad person. If that person I care about fails, then they're an idiot. They're useless, worthless, So it's a very final belief. And from the data that we have, we know that it's the belief that people score lowest on when we measure it, but it's the belief that's most highly related to things like symptoms of anxiety and depression, because it's so powerful. For me to see myself as a complete failure means that I'm, before I even attempt anything, I'm stripping myself of confidence. If I go into an activity thinking, well, I'm just a useless idiot anyway, so I'll probably never succeed, we can see how that can cascade into self-doubt type thoughts and, problematic emotions. So we have this element within depreciation of global evaluation. I evaluate myself totally, globally, on the basis of one event or a cluster of events. So if I've failed, I'm a failure. If I do something bad, I'm a bad person. There's that non sequitur. I jump from the kind of, singular to the global. And that's partly why that's so problematic, as well as being super, super negative, which is also why it's problematic,
As I was reading your book, I actually thought this one was the most problematic in terms of, I suppose, negative psychological implications. Essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you're saying we are placing our value as a person, or what it says about our character, on one singular event. So I lost this game. I'm a loser.
Yeah.
That's potentially very damaging to go down that road.
Absolutely. Partly because you will lose a lot if you're doing it right. If you're winning everything, then you're not pushing yourself enough and you're not going to develop. So as an athlete, as a performer, as anybody who is interested in being successful in the broader sense of the word, you will obviously experience lots of failure. If when you fail, you make the evaluation that you're a complete failure, then that's going to be a lot of pain, a lot of suffering associated with that. I mean, when we think about the human condition, it doesn't really make sense to evaluate ourselves as anything other than just being, the idea that some external criteria can define who you are is nonsensical from the start, So you're already in trouble when you start to do that. If I've not achieved a certain target and that helps define me, and I use that to completely evaluate my whole self, then I'm missing a bigger picture there, that I'm a complicated, idiosyncratic human being that will succeed and fail. I'll do good things and bad things, and I might be good today and bad tomorrow. It's just labeling yourself as one thing means that you're not recognizing that human beings are constantly in flux or in a constant state of becoming. You can never be one thing, So it goes against our nature to evaluate ourselves in that way. Even if we go to the opposite end of the scale and you say, well, I've won something, so I'm a complete success. You fail at the logical door there. And I think it's kind of just applying that rule to yourself can be really, really helpful of making sure that you're not labeling yourself as one thing or another. And also understanding that, Ellis, RBT, had two positions on self-worth. One of them was, you are worthwhile because you're alive, because you're human, so you're worth something. The second position was more extreme, which was actually to talk of human worth and value it doesn't make sense anyway. You just are. you can't place value on it. You're valueless in some ways. To speak of human value is sort of oxymoronic in that sense. You just are. You're in the world. You're by some sort of miracle, you're here. To speak of human worth or value might not make much sense. And then when you then talk about something can reduce that worth or increase that worth, then that's where it becomes doubly problematic. So yeah, it's a really pernicious belief. It's one that I think is very kind of, when somebody has it, you can start to see it eat away at them. And it has problematic consequences that you need to get into as a practitioner, as fully and as quickly as you can.
It's funny, you kind of touched on it there. I suppose as humans, we're all probably guilty of it. We don't ever probably assume that we are a success based on one success, but we are so quick to determine that maybe we're a loser or a failure based on one. It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's partly because we do have a negative bias. We do have a negative bias, and it's probably one of the things that has helped protect us in the past in an evolutionary context. It makes sense that we're more sensitive to negative than we are positive. But, we take it too far. We take it to the extreme. Yes, it's important to recognize when you've fallen short of a goal. You might need to correct something. You might need to change something and problem solve. REBT isn't a positive psychology framework necessarily. There are positive aspects to it, but it's not one of those things where it's like, oh, you failed, you should be happy. In REBT, we wouldn't say things like failure is feedback. We'd say failure is failure. The client defines it. If the client tells me I failed, then I agree with you. I'm not going to convince you that it was a success. But what I won't encourage you to do is take that failure and use that to define yourself. Yes, we can both agree you failed to reach a goal. We can't agree that you're a complete failure. I won't agree with your summation because it goes against the laws of the universe. I think it's these ideas, these beliefs. You would see them in your interactions with athletes, and there's opportunities there to help them to challenge those things. That could be formally. Say you're using RBT quite formally. You're taking somebody through RBT. There's a session one, a session two, a session three. And then there's just the informal, you hear somebody say something, you want to clarify, do you really mean that? Do you really mean that when you fail, you're a complete failure? And they say, yeah, no, I do genuinely believe that. And there's that kind of on the spot checking and challenging of people's, verbalizations of their beliefs. And I think that's possible to do when you spend time within a performance context, because people talk in this way all the time. It's not something that is, these beliefs aren't, like rare things that you might find one day. Anybody that's worked in a performance environment will have heard these things coming out of people's mouths. Whether that verbalization speaks to a deeper inner belief is something you have to understand and figure out with the client. Yeah. But, you would still hear this stuff quite frequently.
Yeah, I suppose in high performance sport or elite sport, you often see these quotes shared on Twitter, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. Again, it's these extreme kind of phrases that only the outcome, i.e. winning, is what matters. So as a practitioner embedded in, I suppose, high performance, how do you navigate that? And are you met with resistance by coaches possibly who are more worried about the outcome sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, I have in the past. I would say that probably more recently, I face less challenge around this, possibly because one of the reasons people might want to engage with me because they might know the kinds of things that I do. And in some ways, after you've been doing something for a while, people start to seek you out for that type of work. They kind of, RBT has a reputation for being quite no nonsense, which I think is accurate. So more recently people seek you out and they kind of understand what they're getting into. So it happens less than it used to me. But yeah, for sure, over the years, lots of challenge, particularly around, well, if an athlete adopts the belief that it's not the end of the world and I can tolerate failure and I don't have to succeed or just like to, then all of a sudden they're less motivated or they care about performance less. That's not true. You can care about performance, results, outcomes very deeply. When you turn that into a demand, to me, that's not caring. It's desperation. When you think about the things that you demand, you're often in dire straits. You're in desperate times. To me, demanding something doesn't really speak to a healthy motivation towards something. It speaks to a desperation to avoid not getting that thing, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that I've had challenges around that. I've certainly had challenges around, maybe an athlete, maybe they need to have this really strong athletic identity that this is everything I am, such that when I fail, I am a complete failure because everything I am is an athlete. I've had challenges around that. I don't believe in that philosophy. I believe that you should be a well-rounded individual that has lots of parts to you. And if you define yourself through one part, then I think that's precarious because when you fail, which you will, you then struggle with the depreciation belief. So I've had challenges around that because there is a belief that, you know, it has to be everything. The athlete has to be completely consumed and sacrifice everything in order to reach an outcome. I don't think that's true, but even if it was true, it still doesn't make it okay. I think when you look at athletes that come out of whatever sport they're involved in, they often come out with some issues, some problems, because they pursued the outcome at the cost of everything else. What do they say? Win at all costs. Well, you have to understand what the costs are. People think win at all costs means, you know, you just work hard and go through pain. But actually often the costs are a continuous battle with mental and physical health issues, you know. So we certainly have challenges around this stuff. Certainly around, does it reduce motivation? No, the answer is no. Motivation doesn't, it's not just one scale from high to low. It's multidimensional. And then secondly, you know, shouldn't athletes want to die? Shouldn't they want to push themselves to the point where they just collapse? It's like, okay, well, I don't know if that's a good solution for life.
Yeah, I agree with you. So we've mentioned the four types of irrational beliefs. We've mentioned the key concept of REBT as a therapeutic intervention. To reiterate, it's individuals' interpretations of the events that cause, I suppose, negative emotional consequences, not the actual event itself. Am I correct in saying that?
Well, it's both. There are things that you could say absolutely trigger emotions. You obviously have to perceive them first, by and large, even if it's at an unconscious level. You have to perceive a stimulus, usually attend to it in some fashion, and then you make an appraisal of what that means to you. So there are events that obviously we could all agree do seem to be triggering of emotions, but it's not that thing alone that shapes the emotion. You have something between your ears,
yeah,
and it's there for a reason. And that's when you apply that evaluation, appraisal, these beliefs come into that, your experiences, your memory. That obviously can shape the emotion. So I think the reason I kind of am very specific around that language is because there has been RBT sometimes is misconceived as saying that if you suffer, you're doing it to yourself. Mm. So that legitimizes any ill behavior towards you because I can treat you how I want because you're supposed to be in control of your emotions and it's your beliefs that are causing your emotions, not my treatment of you. But that's not the case. It's A times B equals C. The event, the adversity, times the belief equals the consequence. Because otherwise we get into like victim blaming. And it's like, well, okay, you know, you've got some emotional responsibility. You can take charge of your emotions. You can't control other people. And you also don't always have control over how your brain is processing things. If you perceive something as a threat, then you're probably going to experience a negatively toned or negatively valenced emotion. And you probably won't have much control over that necessarily. You can shape how that emotion feels, how it's expressed, what you do with that emotion, you know, and that's where the beliefs kick in.
In terms of, I suppose we'll stick with an injured athlete. And you mentioned the idea that A times B equals C. Could you explain, and you mentioned the idea of formally challenging these irrational beliefs. Could you explain how you would apply the ABC model to maybe an athlete who is awfulizing their injury in terms of, I suppose, actual challenging it now, the intervention side of it?
Yeah, so working with an injured athlete who, let's consider that the injury is the activating event. That's our stimulus, if you like. That's our adversity. And is experiencing some distress at sea as the consequence, in part because of that event, understandably. But what I'm trying to figure out is the consequence the athlete experiencing, is it functional for their recovery, functional for their physical, psychological health, or is it dysfunctional? If we get some indications that the consequence their experience is dysfunctional, they're withdrawn, they're depressed, they're seeking palliative measures, rather than focusing on their sort of active recovery, they're sulking, then we might say, okay, well, there's certainly some maladaptive, there's some dysfunctional emotions and behaviors happening at sea. So what could be contributing to that? Then we'd start to do analysis around what is the athlete telling themselves about the injury, about the situation they're in, that is contributing to that dysfunctional emotion. That's where we start to deeply assess the beliefs. So we hold a conversation with the athlete. We explain this ABC framework and potentially what could be happening here, and start to do a deep dive into their beliefs, their philosophies, their ideas about what's happened to them, their ideas about adversity per se. And usually we will start to unearth these rigid beliefs they might hold. Those could be, I want not to be injured and therefore I must not be. It could be, it's not just bad that I'm injured, it's terrible, it's the end of the world, nothing worse could happen. It might be, it's not just tough that I'm having to face this difficult rehab process, it's intolerable and I can't stand it. It might be that because I'm injured, I'm a weak person and I'm a worthless human being, and I've got no more value. Once you start to get some depth, you start to discover these beliefs, and athletes offer them up when you can have conversations of sufficient depth. They're not just sitting around on the surface for you to pick. Then once you've kind of done that excavation work and you've helped to define that with the athlete very precisely, you know, you want to be really precise about what these beliefs are. You want to write them down, extract them. Once they're written down, once they're extracted, the process really is then you and the client as scientists looking at that extracted belief and saying, okay, let's look at this belief and challenge it. Does it hold up to evidence? Does it hold up to logic? And is it functional? Is it useful? So pragmatics. We would say, where's the evidence for that belief? Where is it written that because you want not to be injured, you must not be? Where's the evidence that it's not just bad, it's awful, it's terrible, it's the worst thing you can possibly imagine? Is it logical? Is it consistent with reality that because you want something, you must have it? Is it consistent with reality that when something's bad, it's not just bad, it's intolerable and, you know, unbearable? Then the functional argument, is it useful? Is it actually helping you to strive towards your goal? Maybe your goal is to recover in a certain time frame. maybe your goal is to continue on your journey as a developing athlete. Is this belief that you have, is it actually helping you on that journey, or is it hindering you? And that's really a clincher question, and could be applied by itself often to help an athlete to start to weaken the beliefs they might have that aren't helping them. Because most athletes that I would work with would want to do things, think things, engage in things that are helpful towards their careers. And when they start to understand that something is unhelpful, they tend to want to stop that thing and to do something that might be more helpful. So it's really those three questions: evidence, logic, pragmatics, help the individual to challenge that belief. And then once it's weakened, you can't just leave a void. So that phase is called disputation, D. We then move on to E, effective new belief. We don't just leave a void. We help them construct a new belief that does meet our criteria for evidence, logic, and pragmatics. So if we take a belief like, I want not to be injured and therefore I must not be, we might say the rational equivalent of that would be, I want not to be injured, but that doesn't mean to say I must not be. Just because I want not to be injured, that doesn't mean I get to demand not to be injured. But I still don't want to be injured. We don't take the irrational and create a polar opposite. We don't go from I want not to be injured to I want to be injured, because that's just silly. There's still an element here of being realistic. You know, of course, being injured is bad. If the athlete tells me it's bad, then it's bad. You know, but if they tell me it's awful, then it's difficult for me to agree with that, because the definition of awful that we're using is it's the worst thing possible, which very quickly you can think of worse things than being injured. Say if I've done my ACL, well, what if I did both? You know, what if I did both my ACLs and broke my arm? There's always something worse, you know, that you can think of. So it can't be the worst thing imaginable. You can imagine worse. It's one of the amazing but also problematic aspects of being a human being. Our imaginations can be really extreme, can't they? So that's really the process that we're trying to go through. The ABC element is mostly about analysis. What is the situation? What are the beliefs that are underpinning problematic consequences, emotions, behaviors? How do we dispute those beliefs? How do we help the individual to develop and strengthen new beliefs that are more helpful, to experience more functional consequences? So instead of sulking, withdrawing, exacerbating my problems, seeking only palliative measures, I now am still feeling not so good about this, but I'm actually following the process. I'm actually not doing only palliative things. I'm not sulking anymore. I'm expressing my feelings to people. I'm seeking more support and more help. I'm not happy about it, but I'm not dysfunctional in my unhappiness. So that's the process summed up. In terms of, you know, when you think about logistics, that could be 3 sessions. It could be 10 sessions. You know, you're guided by the athlete in part. But there is a direction to the work that's taking place. You are humanistic to the extent that you're being led by the athlete, and you are taking their word for certain things. You're not challenging everything they say, but then there is a direction. You are trying to help them to create their own solutions, and often you are presenting possible solutions to them that they can select, you know. So it can be active, directive. It can be, you know, you have to be careful. You don't want to put words in their mouth.
Yeah.
But there is a direction to the work.
Lovely. Just a few more questions, because I'm conscious of time and I'm grateful for your time. Thank you so much again. In terms of the E part of the framework, the effective new belief, I would imagine that for someone who was maybe engaging in such severe language for a long time. Like, I am useless. I am worthless.
Mm.
Would that take some time to soften that belief?
Yeah, it would. Yeah, and so we have this two concepts in REBT which describe this problem. One concept is called intellectual insight. This is where an individual can clearly see their belief is irrational. Within the context of REBT, irrational means you're rigid, extreme, illogical, something that's not based on evidence, not useful, you know. This has nothing to do with intelligence or maturity. They see that this belief is hindering them. They see it doesn't make sense, but they are yet to achieve emotional insight, which means that they can actually change that belief on the fly. They can strengthen an alternative belief and actually use that to yield emotional change in the moment, or when they face that adversity again, or interact with that adversity, or think about that adversity, they actually start to experience more functional emotions and start to enact more functional behaviors. That's emotional insight. The ongoing commitment to strengthening those rational beliefs to the extent where I experience adversity and I'm able to enact and experience functional consequences. That's the point that you want to get to. And we're all on a journey to that in our lives. Even if it's not REBT specific, we should be moving through life, correcting our beliefs and forming beliefs that are helpful to us and are hopefully consistent with reality. We really don't want to do the opposite. I don't think that ends well for people. So that is a process we're all on. It's just that in REBT, we're trying to teach people the skills to be able to do that themselves, because we can't become a crutch. You know, I don't want to, you know, do 50 sessions with an athlete on the same thing. I don't want them to come back to me every time they face an issue. I want them to be able to face the issue and say, okay, what's the A? What's the B? How do I break this down? How do I bring forth a new belief that might be more helpful? So you're trying to teach individuals those skills to allow them to move forward. The idea of something of self-depreciation, I'm useless, I'm an idiot. My experience is that people have told this to themselves over a long period of time, and therefore it's kind of deeply ingrained, and they've rehearsed this belief frequently. So the only antidote to that is to rehearse something different, and to rehearse the disputation and challenging of that belief, and to actively seek evidence that goes against that belief. So it's about rehearsal and reinforcement, the same as any habit change. You have to help people to commit to those things over a long period of time, and help to understand that this isn't a quick fix. Or even though the process that you go through might be, you know, typically we're talking 5 to 10 sessions, the work has really just begun for the individual. So it's really important to express that when you're working with people. In terms of unhooking that belief and helping to strengthen a new one, we can't assume that the individual, even though they realize that this belief might not be rational, and they realize that this other belief might be more rational, we have to assess the extent to which they truly believe those two things. Yeah. So in my work with them, I would say, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you still believe that irrational, I want to and therefore I must? You know, and they might say, well, you know, genuinely sort of, I'm still like 8 out of 10. And how much do you believe that I want to, but I don't have to? Well, I might be like 2 or 3 out of 10. Well, okay, the journey for us is to you know, dial down the irrational and dial up the rational. You might never get to 10 out of 10 for rational or 1 out of 10 for irrational, but it's about seeing them as two different dials. You want to try to maximize the rational and minimize the irrational. At the same time, understanding that from day to day, you might have some cognitions that pop into your head that you could categorize as irrational, but that doesn't mean to say they're deeply held irrational beliefs that drive your behavior. They might just be fleeting ideas. Like, you might do something wrong and say, oh, I'm such an idiot. That doesn't mean to say you have a deep-seated depreciation belief, you know? But if you recognize that you do have that, and it's a pattern, and it drives your behavior, then it's like, okay, I could do something about this. I could challenge myself a little bit. So yeah, apologies for the long-winded answer, but I think it's about getting people to commit long-term to the process of discovering their own beliefs, challenging them when it's needed, and then creating new beliefs and trying to stick to them, trying to reinforce them.
I think you mentioned a key point there, not trying to eliminate the irrational thought or belief, but trying to minimize it.
Well, that's right, because when you take something like demandingness, and we take, I want to and therefore I must, you're not eradicating that belief. What you're doing is really elongating it. You're saying, I want to, but that doesn't mean that I have to. The belief is still going to be there. You just have to negate it. So it's bad and therefore it's awful. It's bad, but that doesn't mean to say that it's awful. You know, there's still the architecture of the irrational belief is still there. You're trying to negate it, and tweak it so that you're recognizing that it's not awful, or it's not intolerable, or it doesn't mean a complete failure. This notion that you could just stop thoughts, eradicate them, think something new, great. If you can do that, all power to you. But for the most part, my experience with people is that's not necessarily what happens. There is this aspect of them having this internal running commentary, this dialogue, where they're going back and forth, and they're trying to land on the sweet spot of, okay, my current thoughts, I think these are helpful, but I've gone through a process here in my own head of going from something that might not be helpful to something that is more helpful. And that's an internal dialogue taking place, rather than stop thinking this thing and start thinking this other thing. We have that really nicely in RBT. It's about elongating the belief and negating the irrational, not just being rational or being, positive. That's not what RBT is about. Yeah.
Lovely. Thank you so much. We have been speaking for nearly an hour, so I think we will leave it there, because I appreciate you're a very busy man. And I think that was a lovely intro to RBT, the core points, the main principles. So thank you so much. This is work I'm really interested in.
No, thank you. Thanks for your interest. And it's always great to talk to people who are in this space and interested in RBT, and always happy to come back on and have future conversations.
Appreciate it. For my listeners who are interested in learning more, I will direct you to Martin's books and work. I will leave the links to all that in the description of this podcast.
Thank you.
All the best.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed our latest episode. If you listen on an Apple device, please consider leaving a review and a 5-star rating.